Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordanti. This is where we bring you both seasoned writers and new authors from varied professions across the spectrum. Conspiracy theories are fascinating to many, entertaining to several, and serious business to plenty. This is not to say that none of them have turned out to be true, as many have. I tend to say conspiracy theorists are harmless until they're onto something. With that, there are several debunked conspiracy theories which are being pushed even by so-called reliable sources and experts. We could talk quite a bit about the JFK assassination theories, which there are many, or even the recent Russian collusion hoax, where people believed to be reliable push such conspiracy theories quite hard. Let's talk about some particularly damaging debunked conspiracy theories. Yes, I put a lot of the term conspiracy theories into this monologue because that's the best way to describe them. I'm doing that with my guest this week, Scott Shea. He's been delving into the many anti-Zionist and anti-Jewish conspiracy fantasies in order to push a political agenda. We might think of this as mush spread by fools on the internet. Scott says this is being taught at high levels of academia. He reveals some of this in his new book, Conspiracy U, A Case Study. Welcome to Book Spectrum, Scott Shea.
Chris, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me today.
It's great to have you here. This book piqued my interest greatly. As you take a deep dive into anti-Zionism and anti-Jewish conspiracy theories, which we've probably heard over the years in one way or another, whether it be in a comical vein or a serious vein by people who actually believe this stuff, but you focus mainly on two professors from the esteemed Northwestern University. Considering it's pretty widespread, how did these two instructors wind up on your radar in the proverbial crosshairs?
Well, They are examples. There are plenty more of examples, and I do touch on those as well in the book. But they show and they basically model what the far left and the far right think about in terms of Jews and Zionism. And many readers were, I think, surprised that when I boil down the conspiracy theories of the far right and the conspiracy theories of the far left, that they actually, in the end, sounded pretty much the same. So I started with two professors, one by the name of Arthur Butz, who is a professor of electrical engineering at Northwestern University, who wrote a book called The Hoax of the 20th Century, where he basically says that the Holocaust was all made up. And the strange thing that I didn't know until I read him is, yes, he hates Jews. Yes, he's clearly a white supremacist of some sort. But at his heart, he's an anti-Zionist. He says that the Zionists created all of these strange theories of the Holocaust that he says didn't really happen. It was just sort of a trumped up typhoid epidemic, because they wanted to somehow get some land in Palestine and swindle the Germans out of lots of money. And then on the far left, my interest was piqued by a professor at Northwestern who made the front pages of many newspapers when he gave a commencement address at NYU explaining how proud he was of BDS and how he was part of this movement to liberate Palestine from the Jews. And when I boiled it down and when I did a deep dive, remarkably, they both are peddling conspiracy theories about Zionists that are just warmed up conspiracy theories that people have had about Jews for, sadly, millennia.
Let's be clear. The BDS is the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement that we've heard in Washington. A lot of people have pushed that because they want to see Israel weakened in one way or another, whether it be because they really believe that the land was taken from Arabs or Palestinians, and whether they just want to make Israel kind of disappear. There are definitely people who think they're well-intentioned and definitely people who have strange and rather dangerous ulterior motives when it comes to these things. However, the Palestinian-Israeli situation goes much deeper than what a lot of young people are taught in schools. Conspiracy theories are not.
Well, here's the thing. So let's unpack that. BDS, and you're right, I should have probably defined it. BDS is this idea that states or companies that do bad things should be boycotted, divested, and sanctioned. Now, there are many countries in the world. I have something like 192 members of the UN. And somehow, some way, surprise, surprise, the only country that has a BDS, an organized BDS movement against it, is the one Jewish state in the world. So it's okay what's going on in the Xinjiang province with the Uyghurs. It's okay what's going on in Myanmar. It's okay what's going on in South Sudan. But now we're talking about the Jews and the Jewish state. So that state is not perfect, whereas all the other states in the world somehow are perfect. And therefore, this is the one state that we're going to say is intersectionally needs to be boycotted, divested, and sanctioned. But everybody else is good to go.
Well, that's because it's hip. I firmly believe it's because it's hip and easy to do because it's never going to happen. It's something that a lot of celebrities and maybe popular politicians will say, and thus followers or people who don't want to miss out or people who want to sit at the cool kids' table will want to say without even knowing what it really means and what it can do to anybody. And besides that, you take the D out of BDS, what do you get?
Yes. But here's the thing, and here's the real danger, is that this is being peddled as scholarship on campuses. And people are writing whole books about how evil Israel is. I mean, let me take another scholar on the far left, Stephen Salida, who was a cause celeb, was a professor at University of Illinois. He's written a whole number of books. And he says the problem with the remembrance of the Nazi Holocaust is that it happens in isolation from relevant historical events and worse, from ongoing consequences. It is not very useful at all if a corresponding genocide is taking place, as with the Palestinians, at the hands of Israel. And he goes on to say that somehow the Holocaust, here, let me see if I can find this. He also says the Nazi Holocaust in Europe seems a direct antecedent to Israel's founding. There were plans from the outset of Zionism to rid the Promised Land of its indigenous population. So here you have someone on the far left saying, again, not very different from Arthur Butz, and again, an academic, PhD, scholar, saying that somehow the Jews were behind the Nazi Holocaust, which killed 6 million Jews. It murdered 6 million Jews. It's not somebody's fantasy. My father's family and my father's family was mostly wiped out in the Holocaust, but that somehow there was this plan to create a trumped-up myth of a Holocaust in order for the Zionists to found Israel. I mean,
It makes no sense right now.
Yeah, there are pictures. It's politically motivated because if the Jews can be, and this is not very different, and this is why this issue is so important. I mean, the Nazi Holocaust didn't just happen. There was Mein Kampf, which Hitler wrote, I mean, in the early 20s. I mean, there was a whole intellectual preparation for Jew hatred.
There was a sacred covenant between Hitler and an arguably radical Islamic leader. So there are...
The Mufti of Palestine. Yeah.
Right. You want to go back centuries. Jewish people were persecuted from all areas all over the place anyway. And the Palestinians also got a raw deal. That's a different story, but I believe, and if I remember correctly, both groups were persecuted greatly by same people. And now the whole Palestinian thing is being laid on the Jewish state, probably for other politically motivated reasons. I guess that's the way to put it.
Well, look, if you want peace, I'm a big believer that so here's what I think is the bottom line. The Jews are the indigenous people from the indigenous people of the land of Israel. But Palestinians have lived there for centuries. So Jews do have an indigenous claim to the land of Israel. I don't think that should be set aside. But Palestinians also have a long-standing historical claim for centuries to, you know, large areas of the same land. So the thing that needs to be done is to make a real estate deal and ultimately have a two-state solution. But what BDS tries to do, and the leaders of BDS are unabashed about that, is they say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And Hamas and others make it clear that that means the eradication and expulsion and elimination or murder of all the Jews between the river and the sea if they don't leave. And maybe if they do, it's a little vague. But you don't get to peace by demonizing one people. And uniquely among all conflicts in the world, there's this again, conspiracy theory that is being peddled that the Jews are indigenous to the land of Israel. Somehow they came from someplace else. I don't know whether they came from Mars or Europe, but somehow they didn't really ever, they were never really in Israel, Palestine, and that they did this all evilly, and therefore they deserve whatever fate befalls them. And that's not a direction toward peace. That's a direction toward conflict and toward either war or war by other means.
Scott Shea is with me on Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani, your host. The book, Conspiracy U, A Case Study. I want to get back to the point of your book, or one of the major points of your book, Scott. We tend to have this picture in our minds, and it's an easy one because you see it in the movies, you see it on television, of this guy with a beer belly and a bowl haircut and maybe missing a few teeth with a big swastika flag behind him, the old Nazi flag, by the way, swilling some Mad Dog and with a heavy accent somewhere in the deep middle of almost nowhere, saying, "I hate damn Jewish people and I'm going to like re-eradicate them and everything." And this is what you get. A lot of the stereotype may be true as far as the Holocaust deniers, but this is not always the case. As a matter of fact, it's more often than not that you'll see these guys in shirts, ties, in the business world, maybe working things from behind the scenes, and all over academia, like you say, in Conspiracy University. Going back to Northwestern, the motto in English is, "Whatsoever things are true, the world full of grace and truth." I tend to never trust anyone or any entity which self-proclaims as a beacon of truth anyway. But one would think there would be some vetting going on with professors there and at other colleges. But perhaps more worrisome, Scott, maybe vetting does take place, and views like this are approved, and that could be worse.
Well, you picked up a few stereotypes. So when I grew up, I thought that the solution to anti-Semitism and to anti-Jewish hatred was education. And I think a lot of people sincerely thought that that was the way to go. And then ultimately, once people learned enough, we wouldn't have an anti-Semitism issue. But sadly, and I show in my book that, and I indicate, unfortunately, a number of professors and highly educated people on the far right who were professors and on the far right have created and led serious either conspiracy theories or executed or promulgated, that's a better word, promulgated conspiracy theories. And the same is true on the far right. And I came across one disturbing study that was done not that long ago on anti-Semitism. And I showed that, talk about this in the book. And people were asked about Jews and other ethnic groups. For example, should the military permit a Jewish yarmulke, or a parallel question, a Sikh turban, or the dual loyalty question was posed with respect to Mexico and Israel, and similar questions that were about Jews and other and non-Jews. And it was found that people with college degrees were 4 percentage points more likely to apply a principle more harshly to Jews than to non-Jews. In other words, Jews shouldn't be able to wear a yarmulke, a kippah, a head covering, whereas Sikhs should in the military. But here's the thing that was most striking. Those with advanced degrees, who are the most educated people, were 15 percentage points more unfavorable toward Jews than non-Jewish example. So if more highly educated people are more hostile with respect to Jews, then, whoa, sending people through universities is actually exacerbating anti-Semitism. That's really, really worrisome to me as a person who cares about, and I think to everybody who thinks that education makes people more thoughtful. Well, maybe it's making people less thoughtful.
Exactly. But then you hear a lot of political types, or a lot of people, usually political types, who try to justify all this because, hey, they're trying to weaken Israel. They'll say, but anti-Zionist is not anti-Jewish. We're going to wash our hands of how we think about Jewish people by just saying, well, I just don't like the idea of the state because, well, it moves other people around. Technically, it might not be the case all the time, but peel a layer or two backward, and it's all rooted, or it seems to be all rooted, in anti-Jewish hatred.
Well, I think, first of all, I think, look, it is possible to be against the Jewish state and against nationalism and not be anti-Jewish, but then you need to be against Palestinian nationalism and, frankly, every other nationalism. There's no reason why the Jews should be the only group not permitted national self-determination. I mean, it's theoretically possible, but it doesn't exist too frequently in the natural world. And historically, Jews, when religion was the guiding practice, it was if only Jews would convert, you know, and so the Jewish religion was targeted. And we unfortunately find that throughout the Middle Ages. But even when Jews converted, they were still subject to the Inquisition and the auto-da-fe and lots of bad stuff. That also clearly happened with respect to race. And now that nationalism is one of the defining characteristics. I mean, race was the big characteristic for about a century. And it was the rise of, you know, the founder of the word anti-Semitism was actually a fellow by the name of Wilhelm Marr, who was a German politician who recognized that the word currently in use at the time in the late 19th century was Jew hatred, Judenhass. And so he had to come up with a better word that was sort of racial. So anti-Semitism was his polite way of being able to say hey to Jews. And so he founded something called the Anti-Semitism League, which now sounded like, you know, the Anti-Zionism League. It was a polite way of being anti-Jewish and not having to say it in those words. And to a certain degree, anti-Zionism accomplishes the same thing. That doesn't mean that I think that Israel is a perfect state. I just don't think there are any other perfect states either. And I don't think that if you disagree with France, that you immediately say, okay, let's abolish France.
True, but nationalism has become a dirty word in recent years, too. And again, that's politically motivated and I guess hip. But these are amongst people who really don't know what nationalism is all about, what pride in one's ancestry and nation really means.
Yep.
But one
I agree with that.
Right. This is, again, part of the propaganda that's being taught in academia. Another mistake people tend to make in a highly polarized world is thinking, well, my side is perfect and not against anyone. It's a lie people tell themselves, especially with what you discuss in Conspiracy U. And you said this already several times in the interview. I want to reiterate this. Anti-Zionist sentiment is practiced places within both the political left and right, despite whatever talking head's going to try to tell you.
100%. And I go through in the book and I show how historically on the far right, on the far right, there's no question there's been anti-Zionism since essentially the end of World War II, and I show that from UN votes to ideologies to parties, political parties in Europe and elsewhere, and on the far left, so on the far right, a lot of these theories are actually descendants of neo-Nazi theories. And really, almost some places you can find quotes from Mein Kampf, Hitler's screed. And you can find, sadly and amazingly, still passages that are taken almost directly from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was entirely a fake book that was determined to be a fake not that long after it was published. On the far left, a lot of these theories and statements follow directly from Soviet propaganda. And in a couple of cases, I quote from the Great Soviet Encyclopedia, which was purely a propaganda organ. And those sorts of things are being now rewritten as journal articles by academics who are getting tenure from writing these sorts of things, which is remarkable. I mean, it's not scholarship, it's indoctrination and the closing of one's mind, not the opening of one's mind.
Scott Shea is with me on Book Spectrum, his book, Conspiracy U, A Case Study. Scott, how has anti-Zionism moved from academic institutions, and they've been there for a while, into the culture as a whole?
Well, there's no question that what happens on campus doesn't stay on campus, because tomorrow's leaders are educated on campus today. And that's historically been the case. And to a certain degree, the goal of BDS is to convince people who aren't thinking too much about the topic that Israel must be really, really bad to be singled out as the one cause celeb on campus that everybody has to be against and intersectionally touches every other issue. And so, again, it's extraordinarily politically motivated. It's, by the way, been effective. And it's leaked into many, many other areas. I mean, you wouldn't have had the recent Iron Dome debate where somehow a purely defensive weapon that only keeps people from being killed from incoming missiles is a bad thing. I mean, that's a remarkable. The fact that it's even debated is something you have to credit to the BDS folks about, because that even if Jews in Israel try to save themselves from being attacked by missiles, that somehow that's not okay, because the Israeli state is so evil. It's trickling into media. I mean, the New York Times wrote an article, wrote a piece where, in its book review section, where it was interviewing an author, and she recommends David Icke's "The Truth Will Set You Free," which is totally a screed saying that the Jews were both behind the Holocaust and that Hitler was Jewish and they benefited from the Holocaust, but at the same time, nobody really died. It's actually difficult to understand what the author in that case is writing, but it's written and it's recommended and by an author, and there's no note from the New York Times explaining that, gee, this is a hugely anti-Semitic book. They would never permit. The New York Times would never permit any book written by about any other people on this planet with the same allegations without probably not allowing it to appear, but minimally editing it.
Let's put it this way. The New York Times consistently keeps their tradition of Walter Duranty-style reporting alive into this day.
Yeah, I mean, look, the New York Times did not report on the Holocaust, essentially. There were only six articles that appeared on the front page that mentioned anything going on with Jews in Europe in any sort of serious way. And when Auschwitz was liberated, and on an inside page, I don't remember what page, page 12 or whatever, they mentioned in one line that about 1.5 million Jews were murdered in this camp. I mean, they knowingly had fascist writers. And so they have a long tradition of not really caring that much. And they've acknowledged that to some degree, but they haven't changed anything.
Scott, let's go back to academia. There's no way these professors are sneaking anything past an administration. These people are hired to do the job reflecting on how these administrators and these college officials want to see the future generations operate. Looking at the news of the last few decades, these same universities have fired and shunned professors for wrongthink, you know, not towing the PC and woke lines. So my conclusion here, tell me if I'm far off, but my conclusion here is these anti-Zionist conspiracies, these anti-Jewish conspiracy theories being taught kind of seems to go along with the same attitudes.
Well, let me say this. I think it's not, I don't really blame this on the administration per se. Because the administration essentially comes from the faculty. And the administration more or less wants to advance the university. They really don't want trouble. And they are, to a certain degree, mostly reportable to the faculty. The boards of these, the trustees of these institutions really are there more because it's honorific. I mean, they don't really view themselves as having any, and I've talked to a number of trustees who don't really think that they're going to impact anything on campus, but it's really nice to have buildings named after you. It's really nice to have professorships named after you. It's very, very prestigious. We don't have knights and lords here in the United States, so this is as close as it gets. And the administration, again, generally comes from faculty members of that or other institutions. So this is really faculty driven. And that's one of the things that I found in my analysis. It's, yes, the administration is not doing anything against it. Yes, they are spineless. But no, they aren't the initial cause.
Scott Shea is with me. This is Book Spectrum. Scott's book is Conspiracy U. We've discussed how we got here. Now let's talk about how this can be fixed.
That's a good question. So I have, and these are a few suggestions that I have. And I don't think that it's a panacea, and I don't think it's something that's going to change overnight. But I do think we have to get people away from writing things that are pure theory to fact-based. I mean, let's write actual facts about Israel, about virtually anything, because this is a larger problem. I mean, there's this old saying that Jews are the canary in the coal mine. And it's not just that this loss of reverence for facts is not just about Israel. So my first suggestion is that universities should go back to the basics of making sure that their research studies are well-founded empirically and they're not just political platforms. So that means in the social science and humanities, where this is really running rampant, that more weight is given to empirical evidence, again, less to theories, and that this emphasis should be reaffirmed everywhere. And also anything that gets published should be peer-reviewed by people of a different perspective, not just the amen choir. And that'll take some work, because there is primarily everybody is pretty much ideologically aligned at universities. My second question is people actually have to take a class in understanding scholarship and understanding facts and understanding how scholars have lied and misled and falsified in the name of ideology and personal glory. And my third suggestion is donations from foreign countries need to be limited. Qatar donates over $200 million a year to U.S. universities. They've donated about $500 million to Northwestern over time. And let's not forget, Qatar is a primary supporter of the Hamas regime, which is sworn to expel or murder all Jews from the river to the sea. So let's say a private donor were both wanting to donate to a university and some terrorist group like the Tamil Tigers or Aryan Nations. I think its funding would be questioned, but here Qatar just gives money to schools, and I suspect there's a quid pro quo, but certainly it's troubling.
Scott, what other ideas do you have about universities which can ensure academic integrity in their research and scholarship and not push such conspiracy theories, or at least get to the point where you can teach alternative views but not push them as or not push debunked theories as fact?
Well, that's why I think this idea of a required class in understanding evidence and understanding facts. I mean, people will say that it's a slogan on campus that Israel is a settler, colonialist entity. Well, what does that mean? And we talked about it a little bit in the past, but how is Israel a European settler colonial enterprise? Now, going way behind that, how do you define words? How do you understand theory? And what facts need to be put before theory. There's one person who I was talking to who said they preferred pure theory to facts because theory was pure. It was wholesome. Whereas facts are mussy and they're subject to scrutiny and et cetera. Well, if we don't base things on facts, then what are we basing them on? And I show how some of these scholars, so-called scholars, who actually are good in certain areas, are basing things that wouldn't even pass. I mean, they would make some conspiracy theorists blush, but they take strange anomalies, put them together, and suddenly there's a journal article. And by the way, some of these journal articles are being published by places like Stanford University Press, Duke University Press, and I read these books. How did this pass a university press when they're just basically diatribes that you need to believe before you read the book that somehow Jews or Zionists are evil? There's nothing there. And I think we need really to teach people to go back to first principles and teach people how to analyze and differentiate between a fact and an assertion.
Well, you're also talking about a community, an academic community that will grade papers based on color of one's skin. Many of them are easing up, at least requiring students to write a proper essay. These are things that should have been learned at the high school level beforehand anyway. We have, and I hate to put it this way, we have colleges that used to preach excellence. This is 100 years ago. And now, over the last 20, 30 years, a good number of them are teaching remedial math. This seems to be a war on objective truth as well. It's almost like universities are trying to breed cultural robots, if you will, rather than teach them how to think objectively and how to research on their own.
Well, so you said a couple of very different things. So first of all, I didn't do any research and in terms of affirmative action or that's not what the book is about. I didn't, research.
I was just giving an example. Yeah, just an example.
Yeah, so but I will say this, and the second part of what you said, I think is true, is that the second part, which is not understanding how to differentiate fact from argument, it could be disastrous for society, for American society. I mean, if everybody retreats into what their ideology claims, we're just going to end up as warring mobs. As opposed to, this is why the issue of when people say your truth or my truth, I don't think that works. I think that's again leads us to being warring tribes and warring mobs. I think there has to be the idea that there is a truth that can be discerned. There are facts that can be discerned. And if we don't accept that, and that's why I went back to the Northwestern motto, which is find the facts and then we can talk. But if we all have our own facts, we're just going to shout, yell, and hurt each other and maybe physically do so. And that's really troubling. And that's why I'm so worried about what's going on campus today.
I would be too. Scott Shea, one more thing before we leave. The book Conspiracy U, give me one of the most important lessons you would like readers to take from your book. Don't give too much away, because I'd like to get people to read Conspiracy U.
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you. I'd like them to read the book too, because there's a lot more in there, and I think I really tried to make a contribution to what I hope will be our shared future based on facts. And what I really think I help people do, and readers have told me this, is that I give them the signs for how to see if they're reading or falling into a conspiracy theory. And that's not just regarding Jews or Zionism. I actually dissect the aspects of conspiracy theory so people can sort of weigh early on whether they're getting on the wrong train. And that can be powerful, and that's useful regardless of your political views or your ideological views or religious views. Conspiracy theories are almost always dangerous. And you said in the beginning of this that there have been some conspiracy theories that have been true, but they actually haven't been conspiracy theories. They've been theories about conspiracies that later there were facts that showed that there was some truth to them. Conspiracy theories are unanimously not true. it's a real problem. And that's what I try to show in the book.
Scott Shea, thank you very much for being with us on Book Spectrum.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for letting me talk about Conspiracy U, a case study.
Where can our listeners find out more about you and the book?
They can go to my webpage, scottshea.com, S-H-A-Y, and they can buy the book at basically anywhere where quality books are sold, or on Amazon.
Once again, the book is Conspiracy U, a case study by Scott Shea. I'm Chris Cordani. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.